Welcome to Season 10, Episode 2 of RPG Circus, the greatest show in gaming. In this episode, we discuss how rules affect the mechanics of a game setting, or, as we like to call it, rule set versus setting. Again, welcome to Season 10, Episode 2 of RPG Circus. My name, of course, as I always say, is Jeff. I have not changed my name yet. And joining me this episode as well is Chris and Paul. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Greetings.
Still setting up the podcast station to record the podcast. There is no permanent home for the equipment yet.
Well, you'll get there.
Yeah, I know. That said, you know, the holidays are done, so everyone's sort of now out of their funk for the holidays, and due to a few other things, I have not actually done any real role-playing this year. It's kind of sad, but this Thursday, that's the plan. Thursday, gaming.
There you go. It's all about the goals and the deadlines.
So, yeah, I don't even know what we're gaming at this point. It's just something. You know,
I've done a little bit, but I've been prepping for a Rifts game, so I'm looking forward to that.
All right. Yeah. Remember, everything's better with plasma.
Indeed.
Yeah. Been involved in a D&D game that somehow ended up as let's make a deal.
Hey, as long as they didn't make let's make a dope deal, you're fine.
Absolutely.
Sorry, a little Cheech and Chong reference.
No worries.
So let's start with some news, shall we? There's just a tiny bit, and of course, well, let's face it, Gen Con registration is out. It's open. I'm sure they're going to sell up. They did last year.
You think they'll sell out again?
Why
not? Because last year was kind of a milestone one.
I wouldn't put it past them. It's just, honestly, if they don't sell out, they're going to be damn close.
Okay.
I would not be surprised if... Maybe not now, but as we get closer to the convention, eventually it's just like, we don't have anything. I know hotels are just going to be impossible to get. That's for damn sure.
Yeah, that's always true.
You know,
honestly, it was probably impossible after about frickin' September.
To get a hotel?
Absolutely.
Well, you know, the funny thing is the way the housing pool works with that. It's like the housing bureau handles all the hotels for conventions. And so I don't know how it actually that all works, but it has something to do with the way the city has that set up. They actually have a division for conventions that has a housing bureau. So if you're going to the convention, you can actually supposedly find a hotel room. The problem is with the size of Gen Con, that doesn't quite work well.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's one of the reasons that, like, people I knew that they were going to get press passes even, they were like, hey, you know what? Somebody in my group got their regular press, get their regular badge. So, there was always this mix-up about getting, you know, pools, you know, hotels for this, hotels for that, you know. And it, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I've gone a couple of years where I went into a hotel pool with some people trying, you know, we were going to all pool money, and we couldn't get a hotel room.
Wow.
Yes.
You know, so... And then other years, I got in a hotel room, no problem, but that was earlier on, and I don't know. As I said before, Gen Con has just gotten so huge, I cannot imagine doing it.
Yeah.
Anymore.
It's a bit daunting just to think about it. I mean, you get 60,000 plus people. That's a lot of people to pack in one space.
Yeah. So, that said... We do have a request from the 1D4Con people to mention 1D4Con. So I know you kind of wanted me to read this word for word. I'm sorry, I can't really do that just because it's just... But in a nutshell, 1D4Con is a fan-run convention, and it is going on its sixth year, which is, I think, pretty damn good for a fan-run convention. And
yeah.
They're going to have, you know, tabletop RPGs, board games, card games, miniature games, LARPs. And they say, I like this, charity games to raise money for Extra Life. I'm not familiar with that charity, are you?
Extra Life? Oh, yeah, that's a big one right now. Okay. That goes into it's a charity for kids, and people play like 24 hours straight, that kind of thing.
Okay, that's cool. They are currently accepting game submissions and press pass applications. And so, you know, basically people who are committed to run 8 or more hours can receive a discounted 3-day GM badge, which is kind of cool. And they are also having a giveaway for a free 3-day badge to be drawn the 2nd of February, just before pre-registration opens. So you can either go to 1d4con.com or join the 1d4 Facebook page for more details. So that's kind of cool.
When is the 1d4con?
You know, he forgot to mention it to me in here.
April 13th through the 15th in Martinsburg, West Virginia,
yep.
Which is funny because I actually have friends who live like right there. So if I wanted to go, I could, but that's not going to work for me, actually, unfortunately.
Well, there you go. So, yeah, I'm not going to be able to go either, but that's okay, too. I have plenty of other things to occupy my time right now.
Well, we have the vibes towards them anyway.
Yep, exactly. Anything else that we should be aware of? I think those are the two big ones. Conventions?
Yep, I think that's it.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just dive right into the thick of things, which, you know, as we were discussing, or we didn't discuss topics, I just kind of emailed, I don't know, what do you guys want to do for topics? These are some random things that came out of my head, and this one kind of hit the wall and stuck. And I think we've talked a little bit about this before, but it is kind of a strange one, how game mechanics and setting sometimes don't mix. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Or, as I like to call it, sometimes you really cannot divorce the setting from the game system either.
Yeah. Or, I can see that.
Or you can use a game system that's not appropriate to the setting.
Yep.
You know, I mean, I have my favorites. I like Savage Worlds. It's good for a lot of games, but there are games that it's probably not a good choice for a setting. And as much as I have to say, I'm kind of going to say superheroes is kind of not one of them, even though they do have a superhero setting. I've read the rules. I have a copy of the companion for that. And it's not like it doesn't work, but it's kind of, it worked. No, let's be honest. Most superhero games don't really work.
True.
Yeah. As much as I love the idea of playing a superhero, most of the game systems don't work for them.
They do require kind of a, and you know, that is part of this discussion here of, you know, some settings just, they don't necessarily work for gaming. Mine was recently a World War II game, where it was Operation White Box, where you're using the Swords and Wizardry version of D&D rules to play World War II. Your characters are supposed to be kind of, they start out as grunts, kind of, but they're supposed to be part of special ops. The problem becomes that the lethality of the game system means that everybody should create 4 characters and probably not count on any of them making it through. Yeah. And that's... It can be an okay game, but it wasn't enjoyable for my players. For me, it was mostly just, you know, marking numbers until I did a TPK on it, for the most part. Because as soon as the bullets started flying, people were dead.
Well, which is what happens when bullets fly, but yeah.
And that's it exactly. War, you know, especially large scale, you know, when you get into these more realistic rule sets, GURPS, something like, you know, very basic D&D, 0E, that kind of stuff. When you get into something where you can shoot people from 150 yards away and, it, you know, you have 1d8 hit points and a bullet does 2d6 damage, nobody's going to last long.
Yeah, you're basically going to have to skulk a lot and hope that you get to the high enough levels you can actually do something. And even then... I absolutely love the monster manual for that, but good luck trying to use it against your opponents here, because every monster, you know, based on the CR, is an event that you're probably not going to survive.
Yeah.
Unless you really play it almost Deadlands-like, where you sneak around the corners and wait, try to stack the deck as heavily in your favor. Either that, or you get a ghost tank and basically hide in it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. For is Weird War for Savage Worlds? Is that where Weird War is?
Well, there's actually a couple of different versions of it. The last version I know is a Savage World version.
Okay, I know that. I think there's a GURPS Weird War, and then there was another one too. I can't remember.
There was one for D20 for sure.
I was about to say. I thought there was a D20 one.
Yeah,
kind of like there's a Deadlands D20.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm probably one of the three people that actually host rolled the hell out of it back in the day because I couldn't get my players to play regular Deadlands. And it was right in the thick of the deadline, you know, D20 revolution. We got it to work, but I think it's more due to the personality of the characters than the actual game itself. Because we noticed the armor classes were incredibly low. And even though you had a lot of hit points, in order to simulate a lot of this stuff, and as much as the skill system was an improvement from third to second, you didn't have the exploding dice and so forth. So, yeah, it involved a lot of house rolling.
Yeah. I know a lot of people. I mean, honestly, I think when you look at, especially like the D20 Deadlands, I mean, and you read the history of Pinnacle, especially when they explain Savage Worlds, they're just like, you know, they were like, they played a game and there was just like one combat took like 8 hours and they were like, this just wasn't fun.
You know? Fair enough, yeah.
So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, if any. They have it on their website somewhere where they have like a concise history of the Savage World rule set, how it kind of came into being. And it's an interesting read.
Mm-hmm.
So I wish I had the link off the top of my head, but I don't. If I find it, I'll put it in the show notes. If I don't, well, I'll post it out later when I
That's fair.
So another setting that I ran into that I've been running into is the spy setting, which sounds like it should be a very playable genre. I've been having a hard time coming to grips with it because if you have a single super spy, that's it. That means it's you, the GM, you know, two people, the GM and a player. Mm-hmm. A group of super spies, it doesn't matter if they're super spies or novice spies, is going to be the GM and four separate games running at once. Because they're not going to hang around all doing the same thing all the time. That simply doesn't make sense. That's a waste of resources. And so you really have to force that spy setting to, you know, okay, everybody's gonna have to stay together because it's dark out or something, you know.
You don't want to split the party when you're behind enemy territory, something like that.
Yeah, exactly. You really have to kind of force the setting to work with the general role-playing context. And so it's one of those things where I'm trying to figure out how to use a spy setting and still make it work with a party and still make it fun and make it feel like a spy game.
Yeah, you know, it is tough because, I mean, even Spycraft had that problem, which, mm-hmm. you know, didn't necessarily have super spy per se. I guess eventually you could, but... That was my problem with it. One was the rule set was really dense. You know, I mean, it had all the, you know, and the funny thing is the version I played was their simplified or version from what they used to have.
Nice.
Because, you know, the equipment gear list thing was complex, to say the least. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, you know, and actually one of the adventures that got published for their they used to have an open Spycraft kind of environment where they published some open, you know, kind of like how, you know, you have, what the fuck is it? Like the Pathfinder adventure thing.
Okay. Oh, yeah. The GM's League or that kind of stuff.
Yeah, the kind of that thing. It's League, whatever the League play is for, like, you know, D&D had one, and then Pathfinder has their, you know, obviously Paizo has theirs. And, you know, so... For a while, there, the people who did Spycraft had theirs, and so they had all these adventures, and some were written for the earlier first edition, some were written for the next edition. And the funniest thing is, for me, the funnest one was one where the opening of the session was, you weren't supposed to give the players any prep time. It's just like, here's the equipment you guys have, this is your guys' mission, go.
Okay.
And it was just like the intro to the adventure, because... You know, otherwise, the players would normally get their equipment picks, and that could take, you know, even though it wasn't supposed to take long, it could take an hour.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you'd get the mission briefing, and then, you know, choose your equipment, and, you know, it, and it just, it wasn't hard, but it was just time-consuming, because people would argue over what they're doing, and who had what, and, you know, I don't get a weapon pick, and, you know, some people used, I mean, that was a real thing. It's like, you don't get a weapon pick? Okay, what am I supposed to do with that? And it's like, especially with Spycraft, so, like, one of the guys almost would always try to get the, I don't know if it was like some sort of equipment pick or a feed or something, where bag full of guns,
mm-hmm.
where mm. they were like some just general kind of semi crappy weapons. But one of his special things. He had a bag of guns that he could hand out. Like everyone could get like a gun of something, you know. And it's like you don't necessarily get a choice really what it is, but you get some guns. So everyone will have some sort of gun probably.
Okay.
You know, and it's just like, geez, you know, and you just can't, I don't know, I just didn't find it fun. You know, the mechanics, you know, like you said, it was, and really, I think a lot of the adventures I started playing, and I guess this simulates real life more so than anything else, they were more what I classify, they started becoming more on the level of what I would consider special operations doing today, rather than what I would consider classical spy stuff. But then again,
right.
I think a lot of that is just what's modern, what's not modern. I still say for a spy setting, the best time to play is, you know, the 60s to the 80s.
Probably, yeah.
You know.
And if you want to, so yeah, you end up having to kind of bash the setting to make it fit your... you know, the social group that you have and, you know, the group of people that you have, instead of being able to actually play the setting. So your spy setting turned into special ops, you know, hitman groups and, you know, smash and grab and those kind of things, which aren't really spy functions. Those are more special operation functions. You know, a spy game is going to be generally kind of understated with, you know, the occasional moment of gunfire. And so that's a different type of game. And I haven't seen any games, honestly, that really kind of address that and make it work, especially for a group of people. The James Bond game is, a lot of the adventures are written so that a single super spy can go through the adventure. That makes sense.
Right. And I think that's the problem, is I think for a group of people, it's hard to make a good spy game.
I agree.
And I don't mean that to be trite. I mean, it's just, and I know it's just that, because what happens is everyone has to have some sort of specialized function. So mm-hmm. then it makes it really hard to write an adventure, because then it's like, well, you know, it's almost like, it kind of reminds me of, you know, even though people said D&D 5th edition is not like this, but, you know, it's like, what do you need for a party? I need four people. I need a, you know, a fighter, a mage, a cleric, and some sort of rogue / thief, generally speaking.
Mm-hmm.
There you go. I mean, if you don't have one of those, you can do it, but it's not easy.
Yep.
You know, and it's like, okay, and that's almost how you feel with those spy games. And sometimes in those spy games, I don't even think they quite have that level of sophistication to be like, oh, mm-hmm. yeah, we know we need at least four spies, and they need this specialty, this specialty, this specialty, this specialty, almost exclusively. You can kind of swap some in and out, but these are the set four. I mean, that's just mm-hmm. kind of a weird D&D thing that happened.
Yeah, and as the GM, you end up running four different games.
Yeah,
you end up running the researchers off chasing down leads. You have the muscle man is interrogating you know, one of the henchmen, and this all has to kind of go on simultaneously, because usually with spy things you have a limited amount of time. So it, you know, it's like it's a setting that is, I personally am, is very close to my heart. But I have yet to find something that really kind of brings it to the gaming table in the way that I think really works.
I can see that. The only thing I might recommend that may or may not be helpful is a game I played in the past that seems to... It's good for one-shotters if you're trying to do a spy genre. It's called One Last Job.
Okay.
Basically, it's you're doing one last heist before everybody retires, you know, And the idea is that you have certain setup, and because it's a lot more abstract, you're not sitting around doing nothing. You quickly switch from scene to scene.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it'll help, but it might help you in the situation here. Kind of as a model here, like, you're not wrong. Like, D20 does one thing really good, dungeon hacking. And I've been playing with the system for my own purposes just to see how far I can stretch it. And there is something that's almost like recently somebody, we tried a murder mystery. The GM was absolutely fantastic. And even the concept was pretty cool. But there's things within D20 that are always a pain.
Mm-hmm.
As in, if you don't succeed, the game ends.
Oh, yeah.
Certain situations here. Like, what I would recommend for anything involving that is Robin D. Laws wrote this fantastic thing where he took the gumshoe system and tried to D20-fy the hell out of it in order to try to fit the square peg into the round hole. But again, you can tell that it's not a strength here. Hell, my own experiences when I was writing my own game is I created this really awesome skill system, and then we realized something very important during the game. We kept using it in preference to the combat system whenever possible. Okay. And it really put a perspective of whether we have a 6-hour combat or 20 minutes of rolling dice and trying to pull off crazy shenanigans, you know, until we reach a number of successes or failures. And because I guess we're a more narrative group, we were able to interconnect everybody together. So you're doing this, you're doing that. But because it's all happening as one big job, everybody's going around the table.
Yeah.
In order to do so here. And then you just treat it more narratively. You know, the success or failures you got to explain. But generally speaking, you got to do it there. But the other game, I'd say that even though it's a generic system, it doesn't always fit well. It's one of my favorite games, but it doesn't do everything right. GURPS. It's great if you're trying to play a realistic game. But the second you try to get above 250 points in your character design or like a superhero campaign, it either becomes really lethal or it's really broken, depending on how you build your characters.
Well, and I think GURPS Falls also had a, you know, they had an entire string which I of World War II supplements, which I used to own. But I don't think I would ever have my players sit down and create GURPS characters for World War II.
Oh, no. The research material is second to none.
It was great, but the chances of them dying in the first adventure after spending an hour to an hour and a half building a GURPS character, only to have them, you know, gunned down because they, you know, the machine gun nest made its role would be,
or a sniper, would be, or yeah, what have you.
Exactly, would be like, oh well, that was a massive waste of time.
Hey, could you build stock characters next time, please? Because honestly, and you might as well give it to him before we start. Because I'm not going to customize my character if I know he's going to die in the first round.
Yeah.
You know, I might as well just play Paranoia if I'm going to have a similar effect. At least then I, you know, had a silly character before he died.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I can that's see that. Kind of just the preference here. Also, you're right about one thing. In a game, you don't want to die in the first shot because ultimately people, you know, are supposed to be heroes and they generally live longer. Mm-hmm. It's not very realistic, but when you make it realistic, you end up with a great game that I'm not sure if I'll ever play, Aces and Eights, or as I call it, Oregon Trail, the role-playing game.
Are you referring?
I've never played that one.
Are you referring to Oregon Trail, the old computer game?
Oh, absolutely. And it has the same elements and the same beats. Like, it is an incredible game. I want to try it once in my life, but I have to find the right players, and that's easier said than done because combat's incredibly lethal. It's dangerous as heck. And yes, you can die of dysentery in this game.
Hence the Oregon Trail connection.
Absolutely. Like, your best bet is to hedge your bet and stay the hell out of gunfire as best you can.
Mm-hmm.
Like, a lot of games that become incredibly lethal, you know what you learn to do? Sneak and talk.
Mm-hmm.
In order to stay out of the line of fire when it comes to more lethal games.
You know,
whereas if playing a two-fisted adventure like in Savage World or a D20 fantasy superhero, the rules change.
Yeah, you know what? That kind of, it's weird, but early Traveler was kind of like that. I don't know if you've ever played the original Traveler rule set, Little Black Books.
Nope. I've seen them. I haven't actually played them, so do tell.
Combat can be lethal because the way they apply damage. So, like, let's say a weapon does 3d6, because everything's d6s in the original books. So it does three dice. Well, you apply that damage to your three physical attributes, one die at a time. So let's say you roll a three, you roll three dice. Let's say you do something that has three dice of damage, like a pistol or something.
Yeah.
And, you know, your attributes range anywhere from 1 to 15. You know, there's strength, there's dexterity, and there's endurance. And so let's say you roll three dice and you apply, you know, so the average, by the way, is 7 for an attribute. That's the average die, you know, attribute number. So, you know, you roll three dice, and so you apply one die to an attribute. So, like, let's say, like I said, let's say you have 7, 7, 7, and you roll a 3, a 4, and a 5. Well, you can apply a 3 to one attribute, a 4 to another attribute, 5 to another attribute. As soon as you reach 0 in one attribute number, you're unconscious, if memory serves me right. So, you know, you play this game of trying to apply the dice so that you don't go to 0 in any one thing. And when you go to 0 in all your attributes, you're dead.
Yikes.
So, a couple of good shots, you know, you can be dead pretty fast. I think I want to say a laser rifle does it? I'd have to check the rule book. I want to say it does 4 or 5 dice. Or and one of the later editions, the fusion gun does like 14 or 16 dice. What's the chances you're going to survive that? None.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah,
that weapon isn't really meant to be. Honestly, it's not a personal weapon. It's a freaking. It's basically, you know, you against a small APC kind of weapon.
Right.
You know, it's even though they use it as a sidearm, if you will, it's really meant to be a support squad support weapon, even though everyone in the squad has one. You know. But that's at the powered armor level anyway. And even then. But I mean, so it can be lethal, and I mention in the original Traveler, the way it was originally written, although a lot of people kind of just said you muster out at that point, is as an option, is you could die in character creation if you don't make your survival roll as you're creating your character. Hey, I have this great character. Crap, I didn't make my survival, he's dead. Time to roll up a new character. I know what my point was that so in Traveler at that point you get a lot of this sneaking around stuff because it's like you don't want to get into combat because of that. It does create a completely different game where, you know, combat's there, it's lethal enough that you don't want to get into combat, where you have other games where combat is a little less than lethal, so people just go willy-nilly. And I think that's the problem that I get with D&D at certain times. Not necessarily at first level, but by the time most characters are 5th, 6th level, they're like, screw it. We should be able to defeat all this, no problem. Not suffer too badly.
Yep.
We can survive. Even if we're down to like 5 hit points apiece at the end, we will survive, and then we will have our healing potions, and we'll at least be at half strength no matter what.
Yeah. And also, if you try to run, like, say, a murder mystery or something, especially in previous editions before 5, there are spells that are specially tailored to immediately eliminate certain types of gaming experiences. Like, where's the villain? Detect evil. Are you lying? Detect lies. It just fell away.
Well, you know, and I think that's why I've never really liked the... I don't think I've ever really been able to run a good mystery in a fantasy setting. Or even a murder thing, because usually, you know, granted, it's expensive, but there's always, you know, especially at the higher levels, because there's usually some sort of spells where arts, magic items that they can scry. And, you know, that does, you know, and speaking of impact of, you know, game stuff mechanics, you know, that, you know, all those spells are described as game mechanics, and that they do affect how, in my opinion, a setting would work. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, and that's, you know, and that's why. And how scrying works in one game can differ from another game, which, you know, even if you have two game systems that have some sort of scrying, like I can use a crystal ball, how the crystal ball works may work differently in each game system, but then someone says, well, this game settings for both these game systems. Well, Yeah, but if scrying's a major component of the setting, and you have two different game systems that have scrying that work completely differently, both of them would impact how the world operates.
Absolutely. If you work under the assumption that you're always being spied on, unless you know the specific countermeasures on it, everything you're going to say is going to be in doublespeak. Yeah. Out of necessity, because you don't want to reveal your, well, anything you're doing. And then you basically are playing paranoia for all intents and purposes. Like, it is possible to play a mystery game. And if I had to use the single greatest example of a mystery game, but actually involving a movie, it's In the Name of the Rose.
Oh, Sean Connery flick.
Yeah, I consider it one of his best roles.
We will forgive the fact that Christian Slater's in it.
Yeah, well.
So one thing that kind of runs into with murder mysteries is that whether it's prose or film or whatever, is that there's a lot of ignoring the elephant in the room until the last page. Kind of the same thing with comic books. A new guy moves into town, suddenly the werewolf attacks start, and, you know, the players are supposed to like, okay, well, it can't possibly be him. He's the new guy. So those are the kind of setting issues that I personally run into sometimes. Like, the players are going to latch onto this. Even though they're not supposed to use their meta knowledge, anybody with even half a brain is going to figure out, well, at a minimum, I should go talk to the new guy. Hey, he's got hairy feet and hairy hands. Maybe he is the werewolf.
Yeah. Again, like, this is why if you're going to play a mystery procedural game, it's way better to play something like Gumshoe, which is actually designed specifically for such an encounter. Because then you're getting around a lot of the bottlenecks when it comes to that stuff there.
Well, I mean, that's not really a bottleneck. That's actually it's a workaround. I mean, they're skipping to the end. Because as the GM, you don't want to withhold. I've played in a game where the GM specifically withheld information that would have been available to the players until a later key scene and then revealed it to us. But, and so you're like, okay, well, we would have known this. You made us get to this point because you didn't want to ruin the surprise kind of thing. That to me isn't great adventure design.
No, that's, yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right on that one. Because then
it's not so much about them figuring out the mystery, but just circumventing the mystery part of it and figuring it out from the first step.
Yeah.
And then it's like, okay, well, that wasn't much of an adventure then. We can play a board game for the rest of the night.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny, though. I've had a lot of games like that where you're just like, oh, this looks like, you know, I've even had it in Savage Worlds where it's like, you know, sometimes you have to, you know, you have like, the one thing I love about Savage Worlds is, you know, there's a lot of adventures that are just a couple of pages. But sometimes those two pages, you're like, fuck, I wish there would have been more material.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, absolutely. Again, sometimes the players skip to the end. You're like, well, they didn't really do that, but they figured out what they needed to do, so I'm not going to penalize them for that. But
exactly, yeah. Necessarily a setting-specific thing,
no,
but it is a type of an adventure that can be trickier to run than just your, you know, delve into the dungeon or your, you know, go into the sewers and kill off all the, you know, the undead rats kind of thing.
Yeah.
Those take a little more GM finesse, I think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think what's interesting, especially when you talk about, you know, the infamous dungeon delve, is we've done so much of it, even if it's not right, people kind of know their roles, if that makes any sense.
Yep.
They know what they should be doing. And it's like, we should check for traps. Okay, you're checking for traps, you know. Even if you're, as a game master, you're going like, there's not a freaking trap anywhere in this dungeon. But, hey, let them do their thing.
Yep.
You know, it's almost like, let them waste their time. Let them waste their effort, you know. But, you know, it's just, I don't know how else to describe it. It's kind of, I don't know.
Well, one of the reasons why Dungeons kind of started is the same problem that a lot of GMs have. Hey, I built this really cool environment. Oh, look, everybody's running away from it. You know, the idea that they're running off the map syndrome, whereas in a dungeon, you can't run off the map because you're stuck there unless you, like, leave the first one.
Right.
And that's kind of the idea there. Okay, I'll bring up another one that's kind of interesting. Economics.
Oh, I love the economic one.
Well, you know, like, part of the fun of the game is basically the idea, like, a D&D economy would not work in the real world. However, if you try to implement any sort of real economics on a game,
you could
hurt somebody bad.
It doesn't work. I've tried it a couple of different ways, and economics in games just, I haven't ever seen it work well. There's actually a new game out, though, called Red Markets that I played last week, which is very economics focused, actually. Whether or not it will work in the long term is really a question to be seen. I'm not playing in the long term game. I was helping the GM kind of test out the rules. And it has some really interesting features about how it is very economically based. You're trying to make sure all your equipment's maintained, all your contacts and stuff like that all have to be paid for in different ways. I don't know if that would devolve into an almost board game like experience over time. Not sure. But applying the economics to a fantasy world. My example is you tip the waitress a gold piece. You've just given her a month's salary because you've got gold pieces falling out your ears.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not to mention the whole, that was always the weird thing about dungeons. It's like all this money. I mean, if you really think about it, the amount of gold and stuff, if you use gold as some sort of currency, either you're going to devalue or you're going to cause hyperinflation in the market you're at.
And, you know, why would any of these creatures have gold down there? There's in a dungeon economy, food is probably going to be more closer to your most valuable, you know, your item of trade or barter. But once you start trying to use that in dungeons, your players are like, well, why are we down here? There's nothing of value down here.
Well, yeah. I think, yeah, again, it's just the way the whole, it's just the whole fiat, all that got set up.
Mm-hmm. And again, you're going to have tropes to make your fictional game fun.
Yep.
The question is, what are the ones you're allowed to, for lack of a better term, is the buy-in? Like, and whether we like it or not, there's not too many supernatural creatures in this planet. So that's the buy-in for, say, a smart urban fantasy game.
Mm-hmm.
Or fantasy. Or I want a really cool jetpack. Jetpacks are nowhere near feasible in the modern world. That would be your buy-in.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, I guess a good example is, well, it's one from our previous episodes, vehicles. I haven't found a rule set I'm happy with when it comes to vehicles for 5th edition at all. You know, I've tried a whole bunch of different ones, but the fact is, because it's so person orientated, as soon as you put vehicles in, you get Car Wars. And then you basically end up focusing on that thing because of a necessity.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's either Car Wars or you end up with Mech Warrior, one or the other.
Exactly. And don't get me wrong, I love building cars and customizing and do the dongles. Like, I think we've all gone down the rabbit hole, which is, hey, I want to build my own car and make it cool. At least, you know, weather system or rocket ship or what have you.
Right.
But the fact is, the orientation, a lot of mechanics, you're always going to be fighting between travel by map and, well, Car Wars.
Mm-hmm.
Or to try to get results. And, you know, it's the same problem to a lesser extent when it comes to mounts. You know, when it comes to the stuff there. Like, even a cool, like, you'll notice that a lot of the times games run away screaming from really exotic mounts and so forth. Because in a lot of ways, flying can often break a system when it comes to stuff like that. You know, it's one thing to fly when you cast a spell for a couple hours, but it's another thing entirely when you get a pet wyvern.
Yeah.
And it changes the nature of the encounter when it comes to that sort of thing. Even if you're playing it there, unless you're using it for like narrative transportation, like everybody hop on the dragon. Hey, we're going to Cloud City. And that's something that really has to be analyzed particularly for your particular game.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Also, the other thing is, your equipment often becomes immortal.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's it. Yeah,
You know, like.
And I don't think that's that's every game system.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, it seems to never need repair. I think though. I think that was the one interesting thing about the way Spycraft worked was the reason the gear picks were like they were is that was just since you could change out gear between adventures, it was just assumed that that's what you had available to you. So if you lost a piece of equipment on a thing, the next adventure you would have something else. So it wasn't set. So it was always, I think their assumption was that it was always something that eventually just got consumed in the episode you were in, and you just got something new the next time.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which makes sense in a spy game. It's like, because you're going to, like, I get gear issued to me, and then I turn it back in, and then next time I get some other gear. So it's like, I'm always going to have gear that's in working order. I mean, not return it in working order.
Right.
Yeah, I hear that.
So, but, you know. But other games, you're right, most equipment doesn't break down. And I think there are generally are like exceptions to that, usually some sort of weird in-rule exceptions like gun malfunctions or something like that. But even then, I think the reason that it does, that's just one of those record-keeping problems that nobody wants to deal with.
No. Exactly.
So, I mean, like I said, I think there are games that have some of that. You know, like even in Traveler, I think you're assumed you have to do certain maintenance, and if you don't do your maintenance, eventually, you know, you'll miss jump or something along those lines. But it's just, again, that's minor accounting. You just don't usually. It's like, oh, like in the case of a vehicle, the vehicle got damaged. I have to repair it, and it's almost like everything can almost always be repaired. There's almost nothing that's like completely, you know, or you can fix parts of it. It's not like, you know. You wrecked the car. Well, okay, I'm going to put a new engine in it. Okay. You know, it's not like the car is totaled. You can't do anything. You know, very rarely does something like that happen. And again, it's usually with things like vehicles or other things that you expect, but not everything. It's not like, oh, my God, you know, I have a pencil and my pencil broke. Now I can't write, you know.
Yeah.
You know, that just and doesn't happen.
Yeah, that's definitely a bookkeeping issue that, you know, I'm rightfully so, I don't think a lot of GMs want to deal with. And that's fair enough.
Yeah, and it's so much easier if you're playing like a video game, because then you can have a blade of equipment, you just got to replace it now and then.
Yep.
Because it's doing all the calculations for you.
Yep.
All right.
Let's
cover the last few things. Yeah.
Sorry, Jeff, I interrupted. Go on.
No, I said let's go ahead and cover the last couple of things here, real quick.
Sure. Okay, like kind of dovetail into my other concept here. Gaming doesn't do crafting well, generally speaking. Like, there are exceptions, but unless they're actually focused on the crafting itself in the game, MMOs do it better, kind of, because it ends up becoming kind of like work, and it becomes part of the encounter, the experience. Whereas, unless you have some pretty comprehensive things for downtime and so forth, or it's part of the objective of the game, like, let's say we're a guild of cheesemakers, and we're trying to make the greatest cheese of the land, it would have to actually be the focus of the game.
Mm-hmm.
In order to get anything, any sort of return from the actual concept or idea.
Yeah. Well, I think, again, that might come down to a bookkeeping thing. You know, it's, I think, like, the D&D First Edition had rules for, and we've talked about this before, about crafting magic items that take, like, 10 months or something like that. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I want to roleplay 10 months of crafting. And it, you know, it's a lot easier to just hand wave it, say you charge them a certain amount of money and say it's done. But on the other hand, I can see where there are some settings that actually do take that into account. For example, Ars Magica does.
Okay.
So
again, that's the right system for the job. And
exactly. Yep.
I know that situation there. Okay. I think I'm more or less done. Anything else?
No, I think we should get into the Kickstarters and get the rest of this episode in the can.
Sounds good.
Okay. All right, so time for the Kickstarter roundup, I guess, is what we're going to call it.
Sure.
This one, I don't know. It's it's for Pathfinder. It is Manual of Mythology, Fey Deities, and Shamanism for D20 RPGs. And it's obviously Pathfinder compatible and D20 compatible. And they were asking, you know, $1,400. They got about, I don't know, not even a third of that. They got like 337 right now.
Mm-hmm.
They got 28 days to go. I think my problem with this is there's just so many of these.
Yeah, I think it might be oversaturation at this point.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's not like they're asking for an unreasonable amount of money, that's for sure.
No. I mean, and that's not it. I think when I look at this, I'm like, well, if you need something, maybe, but there's just a lot of these types of books. And then I think sometimes it's just, well, how much do you really need that book? And I'm not sure there's a need there, obviously, which is obviously paying out by the fact that there's just not a lot of pledges yet for this.
Well, again, you got to find a niche and you got to figure out how to build within the niche. Like, it's not, in a weird way, Fae seems almost like the legendary white whale when it comes to gaming. Seems like everybody wants to put their own spin on it when it comes to fictional concepts and ideas. And it looks like, I'm sure it's probably a great product here, but I don't know. It feels like you almost have to sell it to us a little bit harder.
Yeah. I think that was kind of my assumption too.
So. Yeah. Art looks nice though.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
I think art looks really neat. So.
So this next one I thought was a little bit more interesting. It's somewhere around half its goal, right? A little less than half its goal because it's asking roughly about 4,900 because, you know, obviously conversion rates and other things. Has 28 days to go. Has about 2,100. On the Shoulders of Heroes Reborn, and they describe it as a Viking-esque campaign setting for 5th edition or 3.5. You know, I'm down with that. I've always been a big fan of Vikings for the fun of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, I mean, let's face it, I don't think there's a version of a fantasy game that eventually doesn't have some sort of Viking-like culture.
True.
Well, they're the most iconic outside fantasy culture. You know, if your typical horses and knights in traditional medieval ages is a one, Vikings is a two. Like, it's when you want to be exotic enough to be interesting, but it's still pretty beaten potatoes by today's standards. Besides, there's a lot of myths and superstitions with the concepts of these things, ranging from fantasy movies to superheroes. And it's just fun to play the Nordic concepts.
Not to mention, yeah, there's the whole, you know, obviously, oh my God, there's ruins, you know, the whole mystic connection with that, that kind of interlays with the Viking mythology.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Looks like they got a ways to go on this one, though. They got some time, though.
Yeah, they got some time. I mean, at least, you know, for 28 days to go, they're not at half, but they're what?
They're a little over, well, they're getting close to half.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's not too bad. And then
if we get an ounce.
Yeah, and so for the PDF they're asking, well, it's $18. That's not too bad, I guess. I mean, I don't know, PDFs are kind of one of those weird things. You're never quite sure whether or not that's worth it. But again, I like PDFs over print copies for some of this material. But they have a 5th edition version, they have a 3.5 version. And, of course, then they have the the Digital Hero, which has the PDF for the 5th, PDF for the 3.5. I'm not sure why I would. I don't know. It's interesting. I don't know if I would ever do that, if I would need to buy one that's specific for 5th and one specific for 3.5. Unless I played both games all the time. But most people I know usually just do one or the other.
Yeah.
So.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I just thought it was interesting. Again, because I think it's the Viking things. Like, everyone's like, oh, Vikings, let's do that. So, next up, what was it?
Well, it's a fun concept.
Yeah. So next up, we have the Campaign Notebook for Players and GMs. It's just a hardcover campaign journal for you to write stuff in. And I have to say, I like the fact that, not that I was ever a big second edition person, but I do like the fact that they kind of have the faux font for the second edition on there.
Oh, and yeah. They've hit their goal, too.
Yeah, they hit their goal. And so...
Okay, this one they're going to have to sell on me hard, because I'm not seeing anything that I can't just simply scribble up in a three-ring scribbler.
No, probably not. I think most people just did it because, hey, it looks cool. You know, I mean, they have a fillable PDF version for $4. You know, so I guess if someone wanted, like, oh, let's do this, I'll fill it in and then I'll print it out. Because I know there are a lot of people that like to do that. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, at least they hit their goal. I mean, what's the print copy? $5.
That's pretty good. I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it you either have the retro cover, you have the blank cover, or the no titles, campaign notebook with no titles. I guess there's one with no titles inside, so non-English speakers can fill in the sections. Oh, so I guess they don't have, like, the character, key events, weapons, or spells actually written in there. You just have, yeah, that one. I mean, it's not like there's, like you said, there doesn't seem like there's anything special about it. It's 150 pages, so... And I don't even know how they have their broken out. I mean, I don't know if it's, like, in order, where there's characters, key events, weapons, spells. If it's like, I guess that's the way they would work it. I don't know. I think it's just something that somebody buys as a curiosity more than anything else.
Well, that is a way to draw in your market, that's for sure. And, again, their presentation is amazing. That's probably what made them ultimately sell the product, is you now have a little scribbler with the second edition notepad. It has the little red line from the... It's kind of a hybrid between both eras of second edition. You got the blue and white text, and then you got the red underline underneath.
Yeah.
So I'll give them credit for a presentation.
Yeah. That's what I mean. I, again, this is kind of one of those things that you buy to say, oh, that was kind of cool to buy, and it was only a couple of bucks.
Yep.
So next up, I'm only bringing this up because, well, you know me and podcasts. I don't mind sharing the love. This gentleman wants to start Eat Your Victory, an actual play Pathfinder tabletop podcast. He was looking for $500. He has $83.
Aw.
Yeah. So that's kind of sad. My answer to him is, well, do what you can on the cheap. What is he looking for? We are asking, this will pay for the overhead condenser mic as well as the books we need to further the campaign.
Yeah. I hate to say this, but there are already a ton of free podcasts out there that do this exact same thing.
Yeah, I know. I'm just saying, you know, I don't mind saying, hey, this guy wants to start his own podcast. Here's what he's doing.
Good luck to him.
Yeah.
There needs to be, I think, you know, if they were going to do something with this, there needed to be some kind of a hook.
Yeah.
Guest hosts. That are going to play GM characters or something like that. Some kind of a write-up, or, you know, some fancy designed character sheets after the campaign's over that contributors get, that kind of thing. I'm just not seeing a lot of...
You're not seeing a lot to blow the wind up your skirt, as they say.
No. Exactly. I wish them luck. I hope that they continue with it, even if they don't get funded.
Yeah, that's always my wish. And trust me, I think these guys don't understand that you can pretty much, you can do a lot without money, surprisingly.
Yeah. I'd say, yeah, grab your snowballs, get your Skype, record it, and hope for the best.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right, so next up we have Ultimate NPCs Warfare for 5th Edition. Basically, it's, they say, 200 pages of excellent NPCs pre-built characters at levels 1, 4, 8, 12, 16, and 20. So, hey, it's the Rogues Gallery just for you. They have reached their goal because, well, everyone wants NPCs that they don't have, they haven't done themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. And you know,
they're funded. So
they're funded, and hey, you know, for $15, if you're a game master, that's probably worth it.
That's probably worth it. Yeah.
You know?
Oh yes.
I probably would not do a hardcover on this.
But PDF, I don't see where you'd need it, honestly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and I think this is where I have come to again, and I think I don't mind the physical books, but for a lot of, I always, these days, main rule book, I want the main rule book in print format and PDF, and almost everything else can be PDF almost.
Agreed.
Because it's just, it does me no good to have that much material sitting around. Because if I mean, if you look at my like my drive through RPG or even my Pinnacle, I have a bunch of PDF stuff that I have no physical copy of.
Yep.
And I don't need the physical copy ever. And in some cases, I think the physical copy is just basically, I don't know, useless. So, but yeah,
well,
10,000, he won a 10 grand. He's at 16, over 16,000. So, not a bad thing.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Money, and that's always a good thing.
And yeah, I guess there are some, I guess he has some goals, some obviously some stretch goals that he's going to unlock. He has like militias and soldiers, and there's going to be, he has some other ones that have that are currently locked, like guards, mercenary knights, and war mages. So, kind of cool.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right. So, next up, I thought this was, well, it has a, way too much anime for me. But that's, you know, I like anime, but I think it has too much anime influence for me. But I thought it was an interesting idea. Vital Hearts. I don't even know how to pronounce it.
Isekai.
Tabletop. Role-playing. And augmented reality. And it's, I like the idea is where was it? Vital Hearts is a tabletop game where you have not one but two characters, your personal user in modern-day Japan and an avatar and the next generation in multiplayer gaming.
Hmm.
It's fun at first as you balance your work-a-day life with hack-and-slash gaming. And sure, you might dismiss those fake screenshots and internet codes at first, but there's definitely something mixing up around here.
So, I say there's, you know, kind of a little too meta, but we just finished playing a super 80s cartoon where we actually got to play our voice actors in an adventure, so I might be a hypocrite if I said otherwise.
Yeah, this is, again, this is not my cup of tea, but I give them props for something that's slightly a little more original, I guess. I mean, it's not original, but it's definitely not something that has been done to death yet.
Mm-hmm. It looks like they're probably going to hit their goal, too, so...
No, I think they will. So,
yeah. Though, so unfortunately, you know what it reminds me of right now? What?
Sword World Online?
One of my favorite TV shows of all time is Reboot, the original CGA animation. At the time of this recording, apparently they're coming out with the next version of it, where they're kind of playing kids who are basically going to the internet based on my cursory thing, which feels like they kind of missed the point. And that's just a guess. Mind you, I might be ranting about it in about a month, so who knows?
Well, I was thinking that this kind of reminds me of Sword World Online a little bit.
Yeah, and that's they mentioned that as an influence up there.
Oh, do they? I didn't maybe catch that part.
Yep. Embrace the isekai spirit of Sword Art Online, Persona, Excel World, Log Horizon, Ready Player One, Dream Park. But you'll notice that they're, let's see here, I think at their non-crazy level, if you go to the complete game, it's still all in digital format. And then I'm not sure exactly what, so it's the three core books in digital format and then an option to pay extra charges for print format. So it sounds like it would be more on top of that in order to get the actual print versions.
Yeah, so basically getting the there's probably going to be some sort of print-on-demand service that they're going to use. That you can
Yeah, well, they say drive-through RPG right there. They're going to be doing fulfillment through drive-through RPG.
Okay, that's good. That's relatively stable if they make their money.
Yeah.
So, interesting.
Yeah, still, I thought it was interesting enough to bring it up, so.
Oh, absolutely. Like, I might, no, I don't know. Considering I'm teetering on the edge of picking up John Carter from last week... I don't know if this one's as much of a sell, but we'll see. You know, this one's definitely on my radar. I'll give it a bit of time. 24-hour rule's definitely implemented.
So next up we have Deck of Magical Mystery, 5th edition compatible. It's described as a complete 54-card deck of unique random magic item cards for D&D 5th edition. For apprentice-level characters, it's says tiers 1 through 4, so I'm guessing levels 1 through 4.
Well, they're about two-thirds of the way there.
Yeah. These are always interesting, but again, let me see, how do they have these?
Well, I think we talked about these previously, that the cards tend to be of that, they're a novelty, but end up being not as useful, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, that's always been my usage, is that they're cool, but then they don't become cool. They just become like, oh, or you feel like you need more of them.
Mm-hmm.
Which I know people go like, well, that's the whole point, right? So at a certain level, you know, with the collectible card games, you want more cards. No. Because I had the Pathfinder, you know, Pathfinder had their item cards.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a bunch of them. And honestly, they were cool for a while, but it's just trying to carry them around, have them. You know, it was, again, one of those things where it was designed where you'd probably just give them to your players and they would keep them with their character sheets, is the idea. So you'd always either need more or they need to pay you for some. So, but yeah. Again, I like the idea. It's just the difference between liking the idea and the practicality. Cards never got practical for me.
Yeah.
And they, right now they went $15 for a standard deck.
That's not too bad.
No, I mean, that's not ridiculous. So, I mean, that's good. And then $30 for two decks. And then, oh, $75 for five copies. It's like, really? Do I need five copies?
Yeah, that's a good question. Maybe that's probably for stores.
No, because they have a brick and mortar one at 10 decks.
Oh.
And there's
a smaller stores deck. Maybe then?
Yeah, I don't know. So, it's kind of cool. I mean, it's just I'm not something I'm doing.
Yep.
And I mean, I hate to. I don't know from a brick and mortar standpoint if I would buy a deck of 10 and never expect to see my return on it.
Yeah.
That would be my worry with something like this. So.
Well, the problem is if you bought that many, you would have to make sure that you at least got your, you know, at least played for at least a good year with those suckers to get your money back.
Yeah. Well, they might be good prizes for league nights and stuff like that too.
Yeah. No, mm-hmm. I was just saying though, as a brick and mortar, if I went and paid the 10 decks, which granted it's cheap because it's $10 a deck and I would still charge 15, I just don't know when I would see that return on that money. You know, I don't know when I would sell all 10 decks. I might sell one. It might take me half a year to sell two or three decks.
True.
So that's the tricky thing in obviously the retail business with something like this or any product, shelf space. You know, what can I mean, I know people are like, I don't understand why my game store doesn't carry more stuff. They sell, they carry the stuff they know they can sell. So if there's something you really like and it's not there, it's probably because you're one of the few people that like it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the worst thing you can do is go into a brick and mortar business as a fan first. Because then you won't be able to make the hard tactical decisions when it comes to that sort of thing unless you're experienced in the hobby.
Yeah.
Like I know somebody that literally went from a really good salesman to try to run his own gaming store in the city, and let's just say it did not go very well.
Well, gaming stores themselves, as it is, have very slim markets. Most of the successful ones these days are usually something else and a gaming store.
Yeah. Well, they're usually a magic shop and, you know, for Magic the Gathering, and then there's other gaming stuff there.
Yeah. Or, you know, let's face it, there's a reason that, you know, a lot of the larger bookstores, yeah, they carry some gaming stuff. Well, that's they can afford to carry some gaming stuff and still make a profit because they have all these other books.
Yep.
So.
And then on top of that, generally they take the more mainstream stuff like D&D and Pathfinder.
Yeah.
You know, because.
All right. So next up we have Carrot Table, an RPG board for character sheet, dice, notes, and tablet. I'm guessing I don't know what kind of tablet they're talking about. If they're
For your like your iPad or something like that.
Really? Okay. It looks kind of cool. It's like a stack of, I mean, it looks like a tray to me that has lots, you know, like something you'd stick in a table, you know, like a desk drawer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I mean, I guess it's kind of cool because then you could like stack them on top of each other.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Keep in mind that these are actually, they use British paper sizes. So they are slightly different than our American paper sizes. So they use the A4 character sheet paper size.
Okay. Yeah, and that's, you got to be careful because
some things won't fit and some things will. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they're kind of a cool little idea.
Well, I bring this up just because, you know, we do have listeners that aren't necessarily in the United States.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I'm just trying to think of a place where I would use these.
You know, the only place, the only time I think I might use something like this is, I would think if I was running a game at a convention and I had pre-made characters that I wanted to give people, and I would just give them, like, here you go, trays, dice, something like that.
Yep, that'd be kind of neat. Yeah.
You know, especially like if I had a section that maybe already had like some of the game rules on it for them or something.
Yeah.
Rather than a straight handout. Let's face it, sometimes at some of the conventions, the table space is kind of weird.
True. Yep.
So something like this might help with slightly less than optimal table assignments.
Yeah, basically you've got like a little area and you want to maximize. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Yeah. But
other than that, not really too much. At least not for me.
Yeah.
I mean, again,
they made their goal, so.
Yeah, again, it's kind of cool, but.
Well, it's the wood phenomena. You start wondering if you can make your own, so to speak.
I wouldn't say that because having done some woodworking, that none of this is easy. And it actually looks like, from the way it looks like it's built, it looks like what they've done. It almost looks like some of it is. Looks like it's stacked, you know, it has like thin pieces of plywood that they've cut the holes in and it's stacked on top of each other.
I think they're wood. I think they said that they were.
Oh, okay.
They were some kind of other material, I think. But
let's see.
I lost the page.
Here, let's look.
Because they have lids, apparently, is what happens.
Designing. FAQ, there we are. Let's go over there.
Machine. All right, so that's why it's like that. They're CNC machine. That makes sense.
Okay.
Especially chrome-plated magnets are that. Back security. Wood. Highly sustainable, cavity-free.
Okay.
Birch ply table. I mean, birch ply. So it is a type of plywood, and then they CNC it, which makes sense because then what they do is they CNC the individual sheets and they've stacked them and glued those together to make the thickness of the.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's why they probably reinforce it, because wear and tear, I could easily see, you know.
Yeah.
Let's just say I like things durable, and I'll leave it at that.
Well, let's just say it's amazing what you can do with a CNC machine.
Yes.
You know, people say, "Oh, I should just 3D print something." Yeah, but. When you actually CNC something out of metal and wood, it's a hell of a lot sturdier.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Not quite there yet.
All right. Last up, we have a module for first edition, second edition, you know, Osric, DCC, Pathfinder, Labyrinth Lord, basically any type of OCR type. RPG, Dungeon Delve Number 1, Tower of the Black Sorcerers. And this is the first time this gentleman has presented something. And he was asking for $1,200. He has actually reached that goal. So it's 21 days to go.
Yep.
So, good for him, man.
And $10 for the PDF. And as we always say, you can never have too many adventures, especially in PDF format. So congratulations to that's a good start.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know, and he was smart. He was like, I only need X amount of dollars, and he's gotten more than his money.
Yep.
I mean, if you think about it, at $10 a PDF, he only needed 120 backers, and he has 151 right
yep.
now. So, and some obviously some of those backers decided they wanted to do, well, hold on. Yeah, the PDF version of the Tower of the Black Sorcerers. Oh, plus a... And then what do you get? At, oh, the print.
So
some people actually got the print version. Okay, that's what I was like.
Print version's $20, yeah.
And someone, I mean, 91 backers actually did this $20 or more Archmage. You get the PDF version, the digital poster, the print version of the module, and the first 200 copies will be specially stamped, numbered, and signed.
Arm.
See, he was smart. $20. I guess I don't know how many he had set aside, but he had it pretty much set so that if everyone did that, he was going to get his money.
That's true.
And is what he puts on there is actually relatively easy to do.
Yeah. And that's smart. Because who doesn't like to say, I have a signed copy?
Yep. Signed and numbered copy.
Exactly. Ooh. So. All right. I think that is it for this episode, unless you guys have anything else. Jeez.
The bundle of holding.
The bundle of holding. What's great in the bundle of holding this week?
This week we have the they just put out the new one this week. We went over the other ones, which were Car Wars and the Hellfrost offerings. Is the 01 blueprints. So if you're looking for maps for your, it looks like it's mostly fantasy related, maybe a little bit of a steampunk. They have the starter collection at $12.95, which has 7 Great City Award blueprints, the Crimson Sea and Iron Hill Citadel. And then if you bump up to the bonus collection, which was going for about $24.50 earlier, you have a Wild West virtual box set, the Drow City, 7 more Great City blueprints, Nautilus, and an airship. So probably more maps than you can ever do anything with for your fantasy game or possibly a Old West game. So.
Yeah, the Wild West virtual box set would probably be very interesting.
Yep.
Definitely good material, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah, it's a good price, too.
So. All right. Wow. So that said, if anyone wants to leave us a comment, you can send us an email to info@rpgcircus.com, or you can post something to our Facebook page or comment on our RPG Circus homepage. There's always the option to send us some sort of voicemail via the SpeakPipe application if there's a link on the homepage or Facebook. Anything I'm missing out on?
I don't think so.
Just the hell with it. Just send me money. I'll take money.
He's good.
I'll take cash. As long as it's non-traceable, right? No Bitcoin.
Yeah. I think it's not going to be up for too much longer. Can you say tulips?
So... All right, with that, I will see, I think we'll see everyone in about 2 weeks then. What do you guys say?
Sounds good.
All right, we'll see everyone in 2 weeks, and hopefully everyone will see us there.
Right on.
RPG Circus is released on a Creative Commons Attribution US License 3.0. For more information, please visit creativecommons.org.